This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and welcome to Face Connecticut. I'm Morgan Cunningham on WTIC News Talk 1080, Light 100.5 WRCH, also 96.5 TIC. This morning on Face Connecticut, we're going to be talking about a report from Disability Rights Connecticut that finds that the Connecticut Department of Correction violated state law in the death of a Bridgeport inmate who had ALS. And we are joined by Rachel Mirsky, the supervisory attorney at Disability Rights Connecticut. Rachel, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
If you could just start, Rachel, by giving our listeners a synopsis of what went on in this scenario, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you. Of course. And this is a case where we at Disability Rights Connecticut get complaints about instances of abuse and neglect. This was a complaint we received about neglect regarding this John Doe, a person in a jail, the Bridgeport Correctional Center. And oftentimes we get calls like that. We inquire and determine if a systemic issue or issues is at play here. In this case, we had our suspicions that there were systemic concerns, systemic meaning impacting whole systems like state agencies or multiple people in the state of Connecticut. We determined after receiving this complaint that we wanted to investigate the matter, and we proceeded to do so starting in July of 2022. Just leads us to start an investigation, which requires just very broadly a variety of things, which includes like records, record review interviews, going into the facility to see what's going on. I may involve involvement with records and interviews with other state agencies as well.
When you guys begin one of these particular investigations and you have to go and find all of these records, what kind of efforts go into that? Is it usually easy to get access to these things? Was it in this particular case? And then how do you start to comb through all of those things?
Disability Rights Connecticut is a part of a larger system of agencies that exist throughout the country. We're called the Protection and Advocacy System, which means that there's a similar nonprofit, federally funded agency in every single other state. Some states have multiple locations because they have larger populations. And we use a set of federal laws that only applies to us. It's called Federal Access Authority. Those laws allow us to have broad access to records and also facilities, a variety of things we need to investigate. In this particular case, this is a case where the person, because he had a physical disability, the ALS, as you mentioned, that allows us to use a specific federal authority that gives us access to records within 24 hours. That is because he is deceased. If it's someone who is not deceased, there's different requirements on timing. But the law specifically requires 24 hours. I would say in terms of getting access, easy or hard, it varies. I'd say with the Department of Corrections, it's been rather difficult. This is an investigation that took over 2.5 years. We are doing a variety of things during that time, but I made over 15 different requests for different kinds of records. I did not receive everything rather quickly, nothing within 24 hours. And oftentimes I would have to work with the Department of Correction to identify information. They would not respond, or they didn't know what they had, or we had to keep working together. So as you can see from the timeline, it took quite a while. And that's reflective in the fact that the Department of Correction, other state agencies, are not complying with the federal law.
Is that something that you guys commonly find, or was that unique to this case?
We commonly find it. Some agencies are more cooperative than others. Some agencies are not. We commonly find this with the Department of Correction.
I'm Morgan Cunningham, and this is Face Connecticut. If you're just joining me, we are talking with Rachel Mirsky, supervisory attorney from Disability Rights Connecticut, on the report that found that the State Department of Correction, they say, violated state law in the death of a Bridgeport inmate suffering with ALS. What were some of the initial findings in this particular case with the report that led you and your team to believe that state law was violated, and what law is that?
To address the specific state law piece of this report, it's more expansive than that. But the state law piece talks about violations under a couple of categories. That is, there's individuals at the Department of Correction that have other professional licenses, like so people who are medical staff, particularly nursing staff. Obviously, nurses have nursing license, and that is certified and monitored by the Department of Public Health. We also know that some individuals, one in particular who would be a correctional officer, also had a license for an EMT, emergency medical technician. That license is also monitored by the Department of Public Health. We also know that there are some laws and state laws that talk about truthfulness in recording records, so falsification of records. Those are also state statutes, which apply to both medical staff and correctional staff in this matter. In all of those instances, we found that there were multiple individuals, two nurses, and three correctional staff members that that had recorded information about John Doe that was not accurate. For the medical staff, that is recording information about his medical needs, his what we call a COW score. That's a clinical withdrawal opiate score that you assess someone for their level of severity of drug use. That was recorded incorrectly because he was not actually medically assessed. That's a violation potentially of state law. We also know with correctional staff that they have to record observing John Doe's well-being every 15 minutes because he's in a hospital unit. Someone in hospital care needs more care than someone who's in general population. There are several instances, upwards of 15 instances, where correctional staff recorded in a book, like a log book, that they had checked on his well-being when in fact they had not. That is potentially a violation of state law as well.
What are the next steps in this particular investigation and process? You guys have pointed these things out. What does that lead to next?
This is not the first public report we've done. We do approach it in different ways. I recognize now the legislature is actively looking at a variety of matters. The Judiciary Committee is looking at a variety of matters that impact people that are incarcerated in our prisons and jails currently. So the timing is pertinent. We are usually with reports, we keep educating interested parties. So there's a lot of conversation, whether it be with legislators or interested parties, also are nonprofits. There's a lot of nonprofits that care about people that are incarcerated. We are talking to those people. As most people know, in the state of Connecticut, we're also fortunate to have the Department of Correction Ombudsman. It's a newer position. There's some conversations there as well. And we continue to educate people to push for whatever change is appropriate. We did indicate in our executive summary a variety of suggestions that could apply to both the legislature and also to DOC. I do think from the history of the Department of Correction, for them to make changes to their policies, which is a big concern that we have, there has to be some more oversight by legislature or perhaps other entities, whether that be other state agencies, there's also the Sentencing Commission is an option. The Ombudsman may have some influence as well. We try to work collaboratively to make that happen. because we need both change within the DOC and also for the legislature to hold them accountable. There are a variety of ways to do that. And although we've made those suggestions, we're continuing to talk about which of those ways is most effective.
I'm seeing here that there are a number of areas for improvement. One problem being with the facilities, Rachel, the life-saving equipment, maybe a defibrillator or some other kind of medical device that medical staff would have to have access to. It was actually hard to get to those physical equipments, according to the report, correct?
I can elaborate a little bit. In this particular case, and I would say we have concerns in other facilities as well, although this, just to be clear, this investigation was just at Bridgeport Correctional Center, and that we did verify is we do have the right under our federal laws to go into facilities and see a lot of areas that we confirmed that staff would have to go through three separate doors at that time to access that equipment, which could include a defibrillator. And there's some other equipment as well related to CPR. In getting through each of those doors, usually in a jail or prison, you have to allow that door to open, allow it to close, and wait in between the doors to allow each one to open. And the reason I mention that is that obviously creates additional delay. So we had made a recommendation that equipment be placed inside of the hospital or medical unit. Usually, Department of Corrections will say there's some safety concerns potentially with having that equipment and who accesses it, but that's something they need to figure out. It clearly is shown that not allowing the staff to have quick access was not beneficial in this case, and it will not be for other future cases.
As far as other recommendations here, I'm seeing something about man-down drills. In other words, if somebody falls victim to some kind of illness, perhaps they appear to be dead, is there more rehearsal, for lack of a better term, that needs to happen among staff to treat people, to help people who might be in a medical crisis? Is that apparent from this particular case?
It is, yes, absolutely. We did make a comment in particular about how the DOC had their own consultant even acknowledge that across all DOC facilities, so statewide, there had not been, as an example, CPR drills and training since 2018. Surely we all agree that there have been multiple deaths within 2018, and now we're focusing on this one, but we know there's been other deaths. It's been in the paper. This data shows that they're not getting adequate training. And when I say they, that's medical staff and also correctional staff, pretty much anybody, because they have policies where if you notice something, you have to tell somebody, you have to do something. We talk about in this report how they didn't call a code, for example. Also, there are specific codes that are supposed to be called, just like in a hospital setting, and that didn't happen in a timely manner, which impacts other staff members' ability to come who may have training to help a person who is unresponsive.
I'm Morgan Cunningham, and this is Face Connecticut on WTIC Light 100.5 and 96.5 TIC. If you're just joining us, my guest is the supervisory attorney at Disability Rights Connecticut, or one of them, Rachel Mirsky, and we are talking about the Connecticut Department of Correction, according to Disability Rights Connecticut, violating state law when the death of a Bridgeport inmate who suffered from ALS and also opiate withdrawal symptoms. Now, I know we talked a little bit about the ALS condition, struggling to swallow and things along that nature, but also the drug aspect. And is that concerning to you? Because there are other people who have substance abuse history and challenges who end up in the State Department of Correction care.
That's absolutely correct. There's a lot of people that do, right? Like, I don't have exact numbers, but it's a very common challenge that the DOC has to manage when someone comes in through their what's called admissions and processing. That's the first entry spot generally. They're supposed to be assessed for a variety of issues. If they're going to identify someone who's actively withdrawing, they have to go through a process to do a proper assessment. In this case, they were using, I mentioned, the COW scale, which is this clinical opiate withdrawal scale, which is a recognized standard. It's not specifically a DOC standard. It's a medical standard. In this particular case, they didn't properly assess him. You have to assess somebody, not a medical professional, but to assess them, you have to observe them, talk to them, touch them, and there has to be some sort of examination of some sort. And as we pointed out in this case and in other cases, they acknowledge there's a problem, like they acknowledge there's active opiate withdrawal, but you have to actually assess severity because severity determines what the treatment is. and in particular with this gentleman, if you have someone who comes in with more than one condition, which is a very common practice, it doesn't have to be ALS. It could be a mental health issue. It could be some other disability, whatever that may be. You have to assess each one separately, and there might be overlapping needs. And if it's someone who's very sensitive, particularly this gentleman came from a hospital, you have to assess that properly. And if you note that, someone is, for example, vomiting or having difficulty eating, this person had a lot of difficulty eating because ALS made that worse. But a person with opioid withdrawal is also going to have difficulty eating, right? And be in a lot of pain. And you have to make those assessments. They have to be documented properly in a timely manner, which was not done. And so that other staff know what's going on and follow through with the treatment. Even if you acknowledge opioid withdrawal, there has to be follow-up with treatment, not just documentation. You have to actually follow through. And of course, that didn't happen here.
I do want to address what the State Department of Correction is saying, Rachel. And part of their statement is that the leadership at the DOC is in the process of reviewing the findings and the recommendations of the new investigation from Disability Rights Connecticut into that 2022 death of this John Doe, this incarcerated individual at the Bridgeport Correctional Center, and that it takes very seriously the well-being of people under its supervision. That's basically what the statement says. I'm paraphrasing just slightly, but that's basically what it says in short. Do you believe that statement, and how do you respond to it?
I don't agree with the statement. I mean, I'm not surprised. They have the right to review the report just like anyone else has. I have a lot of concern with that statement, and that partially because, we as an agency, we can request from the DOC any what we call corrective action, which is what they're really doing. I'm saying here's a lot of problems, here's the findings, and here's what you got to do to fix them. This is an incident that occurred on June 25th, 2022, and it is now April of 2025. It even indicates in the report that we waited a while, like more than 2 years, like at the end of August of 2024, to say, hey, Department of Correction, what corrective action do you have? And what they provided was very minimal. And not only that, but they acknowledged that they did not have a plan of correction to address the systemic issues. We addressed some that they didn't acknowledge, but they had a consultant to acknowledge systemic issues. And even then, they didn't do it. So we wait 2 years. They still didn't do it. The only correction they've done is individual minimal disciplinary action against different staff. We know one person was fired and there was some disciplinary action that was reduced heavily, and that reduction happened, interestingly, coincided with requests that we made. And those decisions about some staff members didn't happen until the end of 2024 into 2025. If you're really going to be an agency that cares about your people, cares about their well-being, don't you think you should engage in corrective action to help people and not wait 2 years and 3 years? And then when you're asked about it, not provide something and not do something about it. Now you're doing something when it's been put out in the public domain. It's concerning.
I do want to ask you about staffing levels. We talked about training for staff that is there and staff at all kinds of levels, from medical all the way down to regular corrections officers. But what about staffing levels? Because this is something that we've heard about time and time again in the news with the state DOC, that you have fewer officers, you have officers working 16-hour shifts, et cetera. Is that anything that Disability Rights has uncovered?
I would say it's specifically related to this investigation. That was not our focus. Are we aware of inadequate staffing levels for a variety of reasons? Yes. I mean, I can say this broadly, that we are concerned about what kind of care people receive for a variety of reasons, for medical reasons, mental health needs, a variety of disabilities and needs that people have when they enter into the Department of Correction.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Want to pull off the season's freshest trends? You just need the right shoes. That's where Designer Shoe Warehouse comes in. Loving wide leg jeans? Pair them with sleek, low-profile sneakers. Obsessed with the sheer trend? Try it with mesh flats. Feeling boho? Comfy sandals nail the whole free-spirited thing. Find on-trend shoes from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at DSW.
Inadequate staffing has always been a problem. I think in this case, this particular case, and maybe in other deaths, the biggest problem we saw is there may be overworked people, but these were people that were not properly trained. And you also have a group of people that did have training and they didn't even use the training because they're going to point fingers at each other and say, well, you know, this is a medical person, but like what happens with someone who's a correctional person and happens to have an EMT license? Like, just because you're not labeled as a doctor and in that capacity doesn't mean that you shouldn't be using your skills. And why is it that we had people standing around for, you know, several minutes, 19 minutes or more until something was done? Now, they want to record what's going on, yes, but that's a training problem. We have a lot of instances with training. I think there has to be incentivizing of making sure everyone is trained, retrained. I do think with staffing levels is incredibly important. Like, we know about staffing problems. I just think the other piece that we're missing with the staffing is even the people that work there can use more training. They want to be safe. We want them to be safe too. It's not just the inmates, but proper education is really paramount here.
In your years investigating with Disability Rights Connecticut and your time spent with this particular case, does this, Rachel, remind you of any other case that you've worked? Is there anything similar with this and other particular investigations you're familiar with? Or is this kind of a new level of neglect that Disability Rights Connecticut is arguing and alleging here?
We are not allowed to comment, obviously, on any other investigations that may be occurring, only on things that have been put out into the public domain. That being said, we do have a lot of concerns about a lot of the findings that we've mentioned here and how that impacts inmates as it relates to decisions that medical staff do and correctional staff do or do not make. I think the patterns are telling about what has happened at the DOC and what continues. As it has been discussed in the public domain, there's been a lot of other deaths in other facilities. We also, you know, like I know Carl Talbot has been mentioned in the paper, and there's been, some other inmates as well. We have the same concerns. We have the ability to continue investigating, which we can do. I can't comment on that, but I'd say these patterns are concerning, and it's those staffing patterns, it's those patterns about the medical care that continue to be concerning. And this is just the sampling. We don't, you know, this is why we call it systemic, is because maybe this person is ALS and someone else has mental health issues, and that's that person's focus. But in the end of the day, it's the same kind of staff. The same staff go to the same training academy. Same staff choose to cut corners if that's what they need to do, whether they're trained or not. Like, for example, the logbook situation, they have to enter into the logbook all the time, whether they have to watch someone for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, or the person's in general population. That kind of pattern of behavior is really concerning.
Is there anything else that I didn't bring up concerning this case, or maybe your concerns in general, that you would like to bring up in our final moments?
I'd like this to be an added conversation. I don't want to call it a wake-up call, because I know a lot of, you know, the legislature, a lot of people that are interested, even the DOC, they know about these patterns and these concerns. But I mean, we know there are people that come in to the system and are sick. And even the people that are not obviously sick, we have a lot of people with disabilities in the Department of Correction. Now, there's some data it will say how many that is. We have over 10,000 people in the prison system, and a large number of them have some amount of disabilities. The Department of Correction is not, they're not taking notice of that, really. They don't do proper, you know, there's concerns about assessments when they come in and things like that. My point is this: when you come into the system, you have to understand the full person, whether it's records that you get from somewhere else or whatnot. You have to, because you have to give them proper treatment and safety and improvement while they're in there. It helps the staff to understand that. It helps the inmates to understand that. And the other thing I'd say also is, you know, if someone is to die, unfortunately, there's a process for that. And we talk about that in this report, and that's called the medical panel review. This investigation showed, and I'm concerned about other investigations in the future, that was not properly done. And we're recommending that you have to look at the whole person. If someone unfortunately passes away, you have to look at all of their needs, just like you will when they first come in. And that means if someone has a disability like ALS, plus the opioid withdrawal, you have to have experts look at it. What happened? What went wrong here? Let's address it in a timely manner. Let's hold everyone accountable in a timely manner, so that we can say that if we really care about the safety of these prisoners, which the DOC claims, that we're not going to let this happen again, or we're going to reduce it as much as possible. Mistakes happen. That's not what happened here. These are not mistakes.
Rachel, if anybody listening has any concerns that they would like to report to Disability Rights Connecticut, is that something they could do? And if so, how can they get in touch with your team?
They certainly can. So we have a website, which is DisRightsCT.org. We also have a general phone number, which is a phone tree, depending on what people can call it, other things besides abuse and neglect. We cover other things. That's 860-297-4300. We also have the ability on the website to send an email, I believe, which is info@DisRightsCT.org.
Rachel, I really appreciate your time this morning on Face Connecticut. Rachel Mirsky, Supervisory Attorney at Disability Rights Connecticut. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.